Life on Mars is going to call for some adaptation, and future astronauts will need to learn to cooperate under pressure and adapt to months of isolation and confinement. Brian Ramos is an electrical and biomedical engineer who has just emerged from an 8-month mission inside a simulated Martian habitat on Hawaii Island as part of the High Seas, our Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation Program. Brian and his cohorts packed into a small space to assess, quote, risk of performance decrements due to inadequate cooperation, coordination, communication, and psychosocial adaptation within a team. We asked Brian what it was like.
The experience was fantastic. I built a lot of good relationships with my crew members. We came in as six strangers and came out as a team that worked very well together. And I learned a lot of skills while I was in there. So worked with filming with 360-degree cameras. We did geology work. I learned how to 3D print items, fly drones. I mean, there was a ton to learn throughout the process, both in interpersonal skills, self-growth, and technical ones as well.
In terms of technical expertise, what were some of your individual areas of expertise that you folks brought to this?
Sure. So mine, I'm a biomedical and electrical engineer, and I had some experience working on habitat design at NASA, as well as some international development. We had a Google programmer, so we had some programming skills on our team. We had a geologist, and we had a few other engineers, so we were able to tackle a lot of our tasks, geology being one of them, by utilizing those skills. So anytime we had a geology task, I needed to go out and explore a lava cave or something like that. We had some leadership there. We had some prior experience, so that helped a lot.
So although you're not a geologist, you would, under the guidance of your geologist colleague, you'd be able to help out on his projects and he with yours. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. So basically what happened was we would be given a task by mission support and say, okay, we need you to go out and measure this thing or investigate this area and see what you can find out about it. So a lot of times when we had more in-depth questions, that individual would provide a lot more information and expertise that he had. And in a lot of ways, we were able to help with our expertise as well. So, for example, one of the tasks we did was I went out with one of the other members to fly a drone, and then we were able to use that aerial imagery to confirm some of the things that our geologist was saying about the area.
So you were getting out of the dome periodically, but still basically dealing as if you were on Mars?
Right. So anytime we leave, we actually leave in our simulated spacesuits. So we always have a barrier kind of to the outside world. We're not feeling wind or anything like that. We're in communication over radios. And it's similar to what we call EVA, extravehicular activity, mm-hmm. Similar to astronauts, when they step out of their capsule onto the moon, that's known as an EVA. So we would do the same anytime we went out. We would follow those protocols.
How much does the suit weigh?
Not much at all. Not much at all. They're not real spacesuits. They're there specifically to create a barrier between us and the outside world. So they're not a high fidelity. They're just, they preserve the experiment, which is keeping us isolated, keeping us confined, and seeing how we act under those situations.
And the one of the aspects of the experiment was you didn't have communication with the outside world, right? You didn't know what was going on outside of your world.
So we had communication on 20-minute delay. So what that meant was if we send an email, it took 20 minutes to get to that individual, and when they responded, 20 minutes to get to us. What it also meant is that there's no live internet access, so you can't Google things, you can't Skype or video chat or anything like that. So when we had an issue, we have to talk to mission support, we have to send them requests, and then they would try to get that information and send it back to us, which can be a little bit difficult. So if something's miscommunicated, your problem takes an extra hour to solve, essentially. So that's one of the main challenges that we face, for sure.
Is that roughly the time lag you would face on Mars, or would it be even greater then?
That's correct, yes. Well, it's greatest is going to be about 20 minutes.
So as much as possible, you're trying to simulate an experience that no one has had yet. So kind of
absolutely,
Did you feel like pioneers?
A little bit. I mean, during some of the tasks, for sure, we were able to set up our own EVAs at times and go out and just kind of poke around and look at things that we wanted to. And a couple of us really spent a lot of time doing this. So we'd go out and you'd find these giant skylights. They're basically tubes created by flowing lava underneath the ground. And in areas the roof has collapsed, you would find these skylights, and you would some of them are accessible, so you actually climb down, you start exploring the lava tubes. And in those moments, you certainly feel like a pioneer because it's somewhere you've never been. You might be the first person to be there. And, you know, you might be crawling through a tight space or, you know, really getting inside of these really expansive natural creations. And it was quite the experience.
Just kind of a small hint of the excitement that would attend on the real Mars voyage, wouldn't it be?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, what we do doesn't compare in terms of the challenges, but certainly get a glimpse into it. And we had the same with our resource management. So all of our power was self-generated on solar power. So when we had low power, we'd have to go out and deal with that. We had water resupplies, but we had to monitor all of our resources, as you would on Mars.
Sure.
Which really kind of gets you in that mindset.
Do you feel well-prepared by this experience?
I feel that I've gotten a lot of out of this experience, absolutely. I mean, all of us know how to interact in a professional setting. We all know how to interact in a social setting and, you know, around family. Those are all very kind of different ways of acting. This is the first time where they have all been the same. So your colleague that you go to work with in the morning is the one that you might be cooking dinner for in the afternoon or watching a movie with, or all those interactions affect one another. So the way you speak to somebody during recreational time will affect your work, and the way you speak to them during work will affect the rest of your life, and, you know, the rest of your day. So we have to learn how to interact in that environment.
It really sounds as if the social dynamics, the human interaction is really central to this whole experiment.
Absolutely. That's our greatest challenge, is how do you create a solid team and deal with conflict despite, you know, having the delays, having these stressors and things to get done, and not really being able to walk away from one another for a very long distance.
Well, what are some of the lessons you took away from that?
I think one of the big lessons, which is kind of, you know, I think it's true on Mars and I think it's true on Earth, is just having open communication. You have to be able to come to the table and pull someone aside, and as unpleasant as it may be, say, hey, you know, and either I know that you're struggling with this or I'm having an issue with this, we need to talk about it. And sometimes it's just about being cognizant of how other people are feeling and opening the table for that discussion. So sometimes you might notice that someone's getting frustrated, and you have to sit down at the table and say, okay, what's bothering people? What are people's pet peeves? And kind of open that door for those things to come out, so then you can then deal with them as a team and start building in mitigation for them.
Well, Brian, I don't know if it would work for everybody to be locked up with five strangers for 8 months, but it does sound as if it was pretty educational for all concerned.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a very, very positive experience, and I think you're right. It takes a certain set of people who are really dedicated to the mission and dedicated to interpersonal relationships. Without that, I think it would be much more troublesome.
Brian Ramos is one of the crew members who just emerged from 8 months in a Mars habitat as part of the High Seas, our Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation Program. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Observatories is the number one producer of new knowledge in the universe.
I will die for that mountain. I will live the rest of my life in jail for that mountain.
Is Mauna Kea more than just the tallest mountain in Hawaii? What makes this place so revered, so desired, so fought over? Tune into Offshore, Thursdays at 7 p.m. on HPR.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, how Hawaii Island adapts to the changing face of the visitor industry. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa. lehua on ihau ukaua uahu umulokai ulanai umau ukahoolave uhawai.
Our backyard quiz for this morning concerns a pioneering photographer whose images documented the people and landscapes of Hawaii for well over 50 years. He first visited Hawaii in 1908, and when he brought his photos back to California, was charged with obscenity for his supposedly lewd pictures of Hawaiian life. He posted a $100 bail and paid a $50 fine. 2 years later, he moved with his wife and son to Honolulu, setting up residence and running his Kalakaua Avenue photo studio from 1915 until his retirement in 1960. Best known for his black and white photography, our mystery man also produced postcards, hand-tinted photos, moving pictures, and self-published books. His images could be found in Paradise of the Pacific, Mid-Pacific Magazine, and the National Geographic. Our question for today, who was this well-known lecturer, filmmaker, and photographer? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Kapono from the band Jamarek, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hawaii Island probably takes the prize for sheer variety in what it offers the visitor. With most of the world's climate zones, at least two active volcanoes, and more wide open spaces than any other island. As we just learned from Brian Ramos, you can even simulate life on Mars there. HPR's Sherry Bracken is a longtime observer of Big Island tourism, and she's on hand to review its attractions and its challenges. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for talking with us.
Good morning, Chris. Great to talk to you. And I have to tell you, I enjoyed Brian Ramos because he sort of typifies the new variety of tourists here on Hawaii Island these days, people who are interested in adventure in the outdoors, even though he was in a little different situation.
Well, he had quite an adventure. There's no getting around that, right?
And yes.
But it is a new kind of tourist, isn't it, Sherry?
Well, it is. One of the things that I've talked with Ross Birch, who is head of Hawaii Island Visitor Bureau, about that he's confirmed for me, people these days are less interested in the stayed tour type of visit to Hawaii Island, mm-hmm. probably in fact to the state. And people now want to go out and they want to see the land, they want to see nature, they want to be involved in cultural activities. And in fact, Hawaii Volcanoes National Park is at this point the most visited tourist attraction in the state of Hawaii. Last year they got nearly 2 million visitors, and it's all about being outdoors. And of course, in the case of Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, it's also all about seeing the active lava.
Yeah, well, it helps to have a spectacular volcano as the as your calling card, doesn't it?
Oh, gosh, it does. But, you know, that's not the only thing that folks do. They go to destinations that were formerly pretty much off the beaten path for tourists, very much familiar to locals, but mm-hmm. Waipio Valley, Pololu Valley, both of which are at the north part of the island. There's a new birding trail that goes more or less across where Saddle Road is.
Yeah.
Beaches, snorkeling, water adventures. People really like being out and seeing what nature has to offer, and that's so important to understand because that's what we need to protect.
You know, the activities that you're describing, Sherry, they're more interactive than getting on a tour bus and having the driver kind of point out the sights you're seeing out the window.
Very much interactive because people are sort of doing it themselves and they're walking and they're hiking and they're seeing. But, you know, that also creates additional wear and tear on the island that did not exist before because, you know, two people are going in a rental car and they're parking and just it's more interactive in an awful lot of different ways.
Well, as you just pointed out, it does kind of put more pressure on the island infrastructure, right?
It does. One of the things that Ross and I talked about, for example, up at Pololu Valley, which is past Javi on this island, I almost hate to mention it, it's a fabulously beautiful place. But there's, I'm guessing, 11 to 15 parking spots. But because it's so popular now, people are parking on the road, and they're parking a half mile to a mile away to get to the top of the trail there. And the same thing exists for Waipio Valley, which is sort of on the other side near Honoka'a, that the overlook is limited in its capacity to handle cars, so people are parking all over the place. And yes, it does have an impact, a little more traffic, more impact on the restrooms and the parks and just everything that has to go into seeing these lovely outdoor adventures.
And yet the island's share of the transit accommodations tax is fixed, no matter...
You sound like Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim. I spoke with him about 10 days ago, and that is a huge issue. He reminded me, as everybody might know by now, that the reason the transient accommodations tax was created was to help compensate the neighbor islands, especially, and city and county of Honolulu as well, for the impact of tourism on the infrastructure, because more sewer, more water, more lifeguard services, more 911, police and fire,
yeah.
And the latest legislative action capped Hawaii Island's share at about $18 million. And
in perpetuity,
that is the way the law passed. So there is a huge concern, not just with Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim, but the other mayors too.
Oh, we've been hearing about it, Sherry. I mean, it's... You know, the fact that it's a fixed sum, and given that, you know, $103 million is going to be worth less, is going to buy less a year from now than it does today, and so on for each year to come. But it's baffled a few people that the law is written that way. But that's what's on the books, right?
Well, it is on the books, and an interesting question that probably will come up as we get into candidate discussions and legislative discussions in the future is whether the legislative folks have any intent to attempt to change that, if they even can legally do so. But I'll tell you the other thing is that people used to stay more at hotels, and today they do obviously stay at hotels, but on Hawaii Island our occupancy has gone up about 10% in the last year to about 72%, but that is still lower than other islands. So we have...
Yeah.
Empty hotel space, room for more, but that means more people are staying at private residences, which may be rented out by somebody just on some internet site on their own or through Airbnb or HomeAway or FlipKey or any of those other platforms.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another issue, because those folks are a little bit under the radar as far as the county understanding who is staying where and who is doing what. And that's also a revenue issue, because it may be that some of the folks who do that are not counting their property as a commercial property, therefore they're paying low property taxes or lower, or they may not be paying, or they may be paying the transient accommodations tax, those kind of things which do impact revenues one way or another.
Sherry, what's significant is that we don't know what they're paying or if they're paying, right?
Exactly. And, you know, here in Hawaii County, there's at least one effort going on. Hawaii County Taxation Office has added a couple of people to take a look at how to create a registry of private residences. And a couple of the council members, I'm told by Mayor Harry Kim, do plan to introduce some legislation to make a registry happen. But, of course, it would be voluntary for people to sign up. And although everybody thinks the only reason is because of the money aspect, because people's properties, if they are used for commercial purposes, should be paying commercial taxes.
Yeah.
Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim, his background is in civil defense. He is very much about safety and security, and Hawaii Island is also subject to more disasters than any of the other islands, whether it be lava flow or earthquake or tsunami,
mm-hmm.
or hurricane. We just happen to have more of those things, it seems, in general, come to this island. And if you're staying in a hotel, the hotel manager will tell you what to do if there's an emergency. If you're staying in a private residence, it's not clear who would tell you, and it's not clear anybody would even know you're there and that you may need help. So that's the second reason that I believe our Hawaii County Mayor is focused on some kind of registry to understand where people might be staying.
The general perception of that whole sector, Sherry, the whole, the private providers of lodging, the, in effect, inexpensive competitors to the hotel industry, the general idea is that we don't really know, with issues of accountability. I mean, there are a lot of things that seem to fall under the cracks, between the cracks in that sector.
That's true. You know, just because it's an unknown sector, Ross Birch was telling me that there really is no way to truly know how many rooms are available even to be rented out, how many are rented out, you know, what the price of them is, because all of that is just handled privately between folks. But that said, we're still getting, we're getting great tourists here on Hawaii Island, and the revenue that's being brought in by tourists, Ross said last year it was $1.8 billion, and this year we're on target to hit $2.25 billion.
That's extraordinary, Sherry.
We'll it's extraordinary, and it's also the result of about a 14% in visitors year over year. So we do have more people coming here, wherever they're staying.
There's plenty for them to do. Thanks very much, Sherry.
Excellent to talk with you, Chris. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sherry. Sherry Bracken is a Kona resident and contributing reporter to Hawaii Public Radio. All this week, we've been looking at tourism with our Traveling Money series, and we've been asking how tourism affects you. Here are a couple of the voices we've heard so far.
Gus Acosta here. You guys are barking up on the wrong tree with the tourism thing because you're never going to catch up and they're ruining this island. And they ruin cultures. Tourism ruins cultures.
This is Michael Thompson calling from the island of Kauai. I believe we have far surpassed the carrying capacity here on Kauai, and a lot of that is due to the small vacation rentals that are around the island. It's a double-edged sword. I'm very much involved in the tourist industry as a cab driver, and it's good to have the business, but at the same time, our quality of life is not at all what it's been, and I wish there was a way, or I hope there's a way, we could regulate the numbers.
In order to have your voice heard, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. We'll also be opening up the phone lines for live calls during tomorrow's edition of The Conversation. Our panel will be standing by to address your questions and comments on Hawaii's tourism industry. It started with a dispute over a mailbox, and the case of embattled former police chief Luis Kealoha continues to set off fireworks as it lurches toward resolution. The latest sparks flew in a Honolulu Police Commission meeting yesterday, with Kealoha's attorney accusing a commission member of bias. At issue is Kealoha's effort to get taxpayer funding for his legal defense against a lawsuit. It's a Nick Gruby story on today's Civil Beat, and Chad Blair has more in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
It just goes on and on, doesn't it? There have been so many little twists and turns to this story. Am I right?
There have been, and thank goodness that Nick Gruby's been covering the police issues. He couldn't be here today to report on what happened, but I can just give you some details of the story. It's up on our website right now. It was actually described as a pretty tense meeting yesterday at the police commission. You have the attorney for Kealoha, Kevin Sumita, accusing one of the commissioners, in this case Loretta Sheehan, of actually breaking the law in her attempts to investigate the alleged misdeeds of Kealoha. As we all know, the former chief is under investigation, possible public corruption, abuse of power, allegations of civil rights violations. It's a serious matter. But Sumita says you can't have Sheehan involved. She's biased. In fact, he even said basically that Sheehan has had it out for Kealoha ever since she joined the commission last summer.
What's the breach of the law?
Well, one of the things that he mentioned was that Sheehan had attended a federal proceeding, one open to the public, mind you, regarding a former police officer who had pleaded guilty to conspiracy related to that mailbox case. But Sheehan said, "Are you kidding? I mean, this is my job. I'm a police commissioner." Even Max Sword, the commission's chair, said, "Look, what are we supposed to do? Be like monks and cloister ourselves and not be, I mean, we're the police commission. Of course we should be able to go to a federal proceeding involving a former police officer." And Sheehan, really actually being a former U.S. attorney, took apart Sumita's arguments almost as if the former prosecutor she was. And Sumita seemed somewhat chagrined, according to Nick's story. But he still is standing by his allegations that Sheehan should recuse herself. Sheehan said, "There's no way I'm going to do that. This is my job to find out what's going on."
Some of this might well be just kind of a legal strategy, wouldn't you think?
Sure, that kind of stuff does come into play. And there's no question Sheehan has very much been outspoken about officer misconduct, about allegations of mismanagement at HPD. I should also point out she was the only commissioner who voted against the severance package for Chief Kealoha. Remember, $250,000 buyout, if you will, for him to leave the police department. And so this is only more fodder for Sumita's arguments.
And the specific issue, Chad, is payment of legal fees in one of the lawsuits against him, or is
there's a number of legal issues going on. One of them is actually a lawsuit from the uncle of Kealoha's wife, the person who's alleged to have, you know, taken the mailbox. It says he didn't do it. I mean, it's just all sorts of a mess here.
Yeah.
Remember, what's also going on is the police commission is also looking for a new police chief. And we do have some news on that. They're saying probably October, 9 candidates, of course, although there was some concern yesterday that, gee, maybe they should start over to get more diversity. But they're moving ahead to find a new police chief.
And we will move ahead with trying to figure out what's going on with this story, Chad. Thanks very much for talking with
us. You're welcome. Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair. The Hana Highway is a storied piece of Hawaii beauty. The winding ride from Kahului generally takes a couple of hours on a scenic drive. A quicker travel option is a flight of about 20 minutes, but there may be some complications with that route. My colleague Bill Dorman talked about that this morning with our contributing reporter Colleen Uichi of the Maui News.
Colleen, the flight from Kahului to Hana is a popular route, but it seems not to be a profitable one. What's a bit of the history and background with this flight?
Yeah, so Hana was one of the 9 communities in Hawaii that was chosen to be part of the Essential Air Service Program back in 1978. And what that program is it's a federal program that helps fund transportation to different communities that are hard to reach around the U.S. And so Hana is one of those, and different airlines have come and gone at the Hana airport over the years, and some of them have been subsidized. But the last airline that was subsidized, Pacific Wings, they decided to go without the subsidy. That was back in 2007. And so they went without the subsidy for a time. And when the company folded in 2013, there hasn't been an airline since then that has had a subsidy. Mokulele came in 2012. They've been doing it without a subsidy as well. And that's thanks partly to the local businesses. And so the subsidy is something that they're trying to reinstate because, yeah, like you said, it's not a totally profitable flight. There are some people who use it, but I think it's a lot more popular for people to take that long 2-hour drive and stop and see the waterfalls and that sort of thing. So that's why they're looking to get that subsidy from the government.
You know, in terms of the context for this with tourism, Hawaii Tourism Authority is having its Global Tourism Summit this week. And, you know, tourism in Hana is certainly more understated than in a lot of places, but... Ironically, it's likely to make it more popular, the idea of flying there or the ease of flying for some travelers might make it more popular. What's your sense of how important those flights are to tourism in Hana and sort of the future of the tourism business there?
Well, I think they do play a role. The reason that the local businesses were helping Mokulele with the cost sharing was because they also wanted to have some of those visitors come in, and one of the hotel, the Travassa Hotel, was offering a deal for residents who wanted to stay for, I mean, not residents, I'm sorry, visitors who wanted to stay, they would offer a package. So these flights are important to the businesses because they do bring in some visitors. However, I think what is more important about these flights is that they're convenient and they are sort of a lifeline because, you know, during the rainy season, it's not uncommon for Hana Highway to close down due to landslides. So as one resident said to me, that flight can be a lifeline. It's important to have that convenience and that option, not only for visitors who don't want to make the long drive, but also for residents who, you know, don't want to make the two-hour drive to the Kahului Airport, but do need to go to other islands or to the mainland to get a connecting flight. So I think the convenience and having it as an option in emergencies might be the more important aspect of this as opposed to tourism.
So, yeah, not so much tourism, but the residential, and as you say, on the emergency side, medical, that's a case certainly where the flight would be needed.
Yeah, if it's definitely something really urgent, they'll probably use, I would say maybe the fire department's Air One helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, if the highway closes down, it's a nice option to have for people.
Rob McKinney, who's the president of Mokulele Airlines, he says he wants the flights to continue. How would that work, preferring to have the subsidy? But what comes next with that?
Yeah, so last month, the Mokulele Airlines, they sent a notice to the U.S. Department of Transportation saying that they plan to end these non-subsidized flights to Hana within 90 days. But Rob McKinney, the president, he says that Mokulele likes to serve the community. They want to stick around, and so they're not going anywhere. That's just part of the process so that they can get the U.S. government to hopefully offer them a subsidy. So what the government will have to do is they'll have to put out a request and say, hey, we are looking for airlines to service Hana, and so the companies will bid on that. So Mokulele does plan to bid. They hope to be the one to be chosen. However, Makani Kai has also expressed interest in bidding on Hana. And Mokulele and Makani Kai, they do serve some other airports as well as part of the Essential Air Service Program. Mokulele services the Waimea Airport on the Big Island, and then Makani Kai also services Kalaupapa on Molokai.
The importance of that Essential Air Program is evident with cases, as you say, from weather to other emergency situations. But the environment right now politically seems to be a pretty difficult time to go to a federal entity in Washington and ask for subsidies. What's the outlook on that?
Yeah, I know that some people aren't quite sure what's going to happen with the Essential Air Service Program, especially since the president's proposed budget did eliminate some funding for that program. But senators in places like, you know, here in Hawaii and Alaska, the places that really need these services and have a lot of communities that depend on it, they have been pushing for that funding to stay in. And they introduced a bill, actually, that would reauthorize program funding through 2022. And last I checked, that bill is still in committee, and so far it looks like lawmakers in Congress have opted to keep funding for this program in the budget, but it's definitely something that people are a little concerned about and keeping an eye on based on what the president had originally proposed in his budget. So we'll see what happens with that.
It really does seem to be a situation, though, that's going to need some political persuasion, certainly, and again, not just with the overall program itself, but as it applies to Hana as well. Any plans to sort of bring political persuasion to the table or something that could help along those lines?
Right now, I don't think the county is considering doing anything to kind of help that along yet, just because there isn't, it doesn't look like we're going to lose air service yet. If the U.S. Department of Transportation doesn't put out a request or they say we can't find anyone, then that might be a problem, and then the county might start to look at that and say, oh, what do we have to do about that? But right now, I think people are pretty comfortable. Mokulele is still continuing to service, and actually they're required to continue to service Hana until a new airline can be found. So I don't think there's a whole lot of concern on the county side about losing air service to Hana quite yet.
So it's not a sense of urgency if the rug is going to be pulled out in a short-term kind of crisis sort of way?
Not that I can tell, especially because, like I said, Mokulele has to continue servicing Hana until they can find a replacement. So that's one of the key components in continuing the service over there that I think people are a little more comfortable about.
And on the broader point on priorities, concerns, worries when it comes to travel and connections, anything else that's out there that's concerning them these days?
No, I believe it's mainly just having other options of transportation, just because the highway, like I said, can't always count on it when there are storms and there are landslides, and recently there were sinkholes. So, you know, people just want to have different options and make sure that the town of Hana can be reached no matter what happens.
So we'll see what happens. I know you mentioned the 90-day clock sort of on that ticking. Is that the sort of the main time constraint going forward, or when do you think that we'll hear more in terms of next step or moving towards a resolution on this?
Yeah, that is the main time constraint. I talked to Rob McKinney, and he said that's usually enough time for them to kind of find somebody else to do it or to choose Mokulele. They could ask for a time extension, but he said that generally 90 days is enough for them.
And could be heading into a situation of a competitive bid after that.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting if Makani Kai throws their hat in the ring.
All right, we'll keep an eye on that. Thanks very much, Colleen. Colleen Awechi of the Maui News, contributing reporter for Hawaii Public Radio. Colleen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Bill. It was a pleasure.
Aloha, this is Kupa'a. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier, we asked you to identify an artist who spent the bulk of his career capturing the people and scenery of Hawaii through the lens of his camera. Born in Rockford, Illinois in 1880, our prolific shutterbug briefly attended the University of Minnesota before he found his calling as a traveling photographer. He first worked in Portland, Oregon, and then settled in Eureka, California. A brief visit to Hawaii in 1908 left a huge impression. He relocated his young family to Honolulu 2 years later. Working out of his home studio on Kalakaua Avenue, his photos, postcards, and books found a market with the tourist industry, and his work was published in Mid-Pacific Magazine as well as the National Geographic. His memoir, Odyssey of a Cameraman, was published in 1964, and today you'll find a large collection of original Ray Jerome Baker prints, glass plate slides, and negatives at the Bishop Museum. And Julie Prado of Kailua Kona got the answer right. Congratulations, Julie. You're today's winner. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii's visitor industry is becoming more Hawaiian, offering tourists more in the way of authentic cultural exposure, and even more importantly, investing in cultural tourism. HPR reporter Kuuvei Hiraishi has been watching the trend evolve and hearing it touted at this week's Visitor Industry Summit. She's with us in our studio. Hi, Kuuvei.
Aloha, Chris.
Thanks for coming in.
Of course.
We've been feeling a change in the air for a while now, but it's really becoming pretty pronounced these days.
Yes. So when I went to the Global Tourism Summit yesterday, in fact, there were about a half a dozen cultural practitioners. So mm-hmm. you had Delani Tanahi beating kapa. You had uh-huh. Umi Kai making his implements. Pohaku Stone with his giant surfboards made out of Native Hawaiian woods. And
wow.
these were on display very prominently mm-hmm. at the summit, which is something that 20 years ago, you probably would not see.
It's likely you would not. And I know 20 years ago, a lot of people were complaining that we were kind of becoming Las Vegas.
Exactly. There's always going to be that fear, I think, that we are going to just exploit everything possible for that dollar, for that tourism dollar especially.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole idea of the way tourism, that what we might call the old paradigm of tourism, has kind of created some resentment. I mean, we both heard a caller in the show a little bit earlier say, what, tourism destroys culture?
That's
angrily saying that, right?
Exactly. And there is that sentiment in the wider community. And I think in the Native Hawaiian community as well, there is a bit of that. I did speak to Kalani Kana'ana, who's the cultural programs director over at the Hawaii Tourism Authority. Mm-hmm. And he says that's a constant struggle to try to engage that community in the tourism industry. Because for a long time, there wasn't a good representation by Native Hawaiians who were involved in the industry. It was sort of this reluctance to get involved. We don't want to, they're not properly portraying our culture, so mm-hmm. why would I want to get involved in that?
Mm-hmm.
But the change in that mindset and having people like Kalani at the Hawaii Tourism Authority and having folks like the Native Hawaiian Hospitality Association out there very kind of giving exposure to folks like those cultural practitioners has really made some changes in the way that the culture is portrayed and making sure that there is that balance of culture and commerce to the point where we're not going to water down the culture just to make that money.
And that's a concern because people who, you know, are close to Hawaiian culture, cultural practitioners, anyone who cares about it doesn't want to see it cheapened. And that's the perception of what tourism might do. I suspect that was behind what that caller was saying, for example.
Exactly. And I think that there is still a little bit of that in our cultural practitioners. But because the Hawaii Tourism Authority and folks have been reaching out, the industry has been reaching out to these folks, knowing that it'll help the value of the tourism product, if you will, to have an authentic cultural practitioner there doing what they've been doing for decades, that's going to add to more visitors wanting to have that same experience. And knowing that, it sort of keeps the value going good, and it also keeps folks involved.
Well, you know, Kuvehi, you heard our discussion yesterday with the woodcarver Manny Matos, who is now out in the Waimea Valley. And he himself said, you know, he was reluctant to take part, and this is a funded program that has him doing his thing for visitors, but he said he was very pleasantly surprised by the degree of interest that visitors were showing. They're saying, I came here, I want to learn about your culture, I don't want to just lie on the beach.
And that is a trend that we are seeing with cultural tourism, and I think Sherry Bracken had touched on it earlier.
Yeah.
Our tourists, the visitors that are coming here, want more than that prepackaged, you know, mass-produced experience. Mm-hmm. They don't want to go to the luau where they can hardly see the stage. They want to go to this sort of intimate setting where they can talk to someone who is making laulau for them. You know, they're looking for different experiences, and I think the industry has seen that and responding by investing in people like Manny to give those experiences.
Has it maybe been a little bit late to the party?
Oh, that's a good question, and I don't know that it's better late than never, I would want to say, because
no argument there.
Yeah.
Few would argue with that, right?
Exactly, I think from talking to a lot of the folks in the industry, they are pleased with the representation of the Hawaiian culture, but it is a constant everyday struggle that they will continue. You know, as long as they're a part of the conversation, we should see some very positive results.
Well, certainly that conversation, as long as I can remember, over 35 years here, has been, you know, there are a lot of places where you can go and lie on the beach.
Exactly. And
what is unique about us?
Exactly. And that is what we keep on saying, is that the Hawaiian culture is at the core and the foundation of what brings visitors to Hawaii. So investing in that is something that I think the industry sees as has a lot of value.
You know, we all remember the opening sequence of the television program Hawaii 5-0, which got a lot of people thinking about, I might want to go to Hawaii. And a lot of the sort of flashy things they showed in that, I'm just using that as an example, right, were not particularly Hawaiian, right? Because, you know, it was very pounding drums. It was sort of pumped up excitement. It doesn't really address the whole nature of a lot of Hawaiian art, slack key and hula, that is more sort of nahe nahe.
Right. The tiki culture and the sort of that older grass skirts mentality. And that still exists in some corners of the world in terms of the reputation that Hawaii has and Hawaiian culture has. Mm-hmm. But I think we've seen a drastic change in terms of increased awareness of what authentic Hawaiian culture does look like. And I think a lot of it has to do with the increasing number of Native Hawaiians in the tourism industry, not just as at the hotels or restaurants, but in leadership positions.
In the decision-making.
Exactly. Ranks, they're at the table saying, no.
Yeah.
That's not Hawaiian. And that makes a huge difference.
At the convention center this week, have you gotten a sense of a mood? You know, is there an optimistic mood in general about Hawaii tourism?
It is. And it's every year the Global Tourism Summit or the annual conference run by HTA is always very, very upbeat. There's never any doom and gloom. But I think having folks like the cultural practitioners out there and having Hawaiian music, just having the people in the tourism industry from around the world get an idea of what it means, a sense of place to be here and be exposed to the culture in the way that they are, I think it convinces them that they can bring people here and do it in a responsible way.
Well, we're certainly seeing that in other parts of the world. You know, the keynote speaker at the summit was from Iceland, and we talked to her a few days ago, basically saying that people are interested in Icelandic culture when they come, you know, because they're not going to find it anywhere else except where she lives, right?
Exactly. And that's the same thing that is going on at the Global Tourism Summit this week, is just an increased awareness that, you know, the thing that brings people here is the culture, and we better continue to invest in it.
Well, it certainly is. It's quite a shift from how it used to be. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, how many more programs like the ones we've been hearing about, how many more of those come about.
Definitely. It's going to be an exciting future, I think, for cultural tourism in Hawaii.
Well, the thing about any kind of investment is you've got to give it some time to see if it pays off, right?
Yes. Gradual growth is what our cultural tourism folks were saying.
Well, let's hope for the best. Thanks a lot, Kuvei.
Mahalo.
Kuvei Hiraishi is HPR's General Assignment Reporter. The Global Tourism Summit concludes today at the Hawaii Convention Center in Honolulu.
Tourism powers Hawaii's economy. Visitors spend $43 million every day. Last year, that meant nearly $2 billion in state tax revenue and nearly 200,000 jobs. But along with the benefits come some costs. Join us all week for Traveling Money, Managing Hawaii's Tourism Future on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and The Conversation. Listen for your chance to call in live and join the conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout our state, and our Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar today. Well, we've got a few of those, don't we, Derek?
Yes. Coming up tomorrow, Hawaii's Wood Show hosts a free lecture and presentation on Friday. Mark Safiri will share stories about his four decades of creating unique furniture and sculpture. This lecture is from 5 to 6 p.m. in the Honolulu Museum of Art School at Line Kona, and it's in advance of Hawaii's Wood Show, which starts on Saturday at the art school.
Yeah, he specializes in multi-axis turning techniques.
Yes,
We're going to have to go and find out.
I can only imagine what that is.
I'm sort of forming a picture in my mind, but it'd be interesting to find out. And you can see your favorite surfers in a film tomorrow at Maui's Castle Theater.
The movie is called Paradigm Lost. And Ryan, who works on our show, would be very interested in this. You'll see a bunch of surfers in this movie, including Kai Lenny, John Florence, Kelly Slater, Robbie Nash, Clyde Aikau, Laird Hamilton, and a bunch more. It's tomorrow at 6:30 in the Castle Theater on Maui. There is an admission fee for that.
And if you ride a bike, you might want to learn how to fix it, right?
Yet tomorrow there is a hands-on introductory course that will teach you how to keep your bike in tip-top shape. The Hawaii Bicycling League is sponsoring this workshop and will provide the tools. It's in the Alawai Golf Course Clubhouse Ballroom. It's free, but you need to register at the address on our website. And once you go there, you can find the time for this workshop as well.
Okay.
Because I forgot to put it in.
That's quite all right, Derek.
Okay,
I'm sure that we'll figure it out. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Tomorrow we're opening up our phone lines to conclude our week-long series, Traveling Money. Hawaii economist Paul Brubaker and Jeff Bolin, CEO of Sustainable Travel International, will be here with us. If you want to record a question or comment beforehand, call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. I'm Chris Vandercook, and join us tomorrow.